Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. This is a very non-special edition. I'm Terry Foy, joined by Patrick McEwen and Kyle Devitt. And the reason it's not special is because we are sitting in a car in a parking lot in Bel Air, Maryland, during the Inside Lacrosse July Recruiting Invitational, as we are winding down the final day of action, and we're all out here watching action on the fields. But, fellas, we have a lot to discuss in the MLL. This is traditionally the MLL podcast that comes out on Wednesdays. We had a quiet week, relatively speaking, although there's probably ways in which you can spin it the exact opposite direction. But we had a quiet week because there were no MLL games, minus the MLL All-Star game, which was played in Sacramento, California. We'll get back to that later on in the show. A lot of the action was on Twitter, basically, as the vocal discontent among players reached what I would consider to be an all-time high, and we're going to address that. But more than anything else, we're here to discuss the U.S. National Team tryouts, which got underway Monday at U.S. Lacrosse headquarters in Sparks, Maryland. Coach Jonathan Oski, his staff, and a team of evaluators began Monday evening running their players through drills and then beginning competition sessions Tuesday morning. There are four sessions in total. It runs through Wednesday late morning, and at that point, there will be an announcement, maybe after this podcast is already posted, or before this podcast is posted, you'll have seen the reduction in the roughly 75 members of the team down to a number that, to my knowledge, has not been determined and will probably be a reflection of player performance. I attended the Monday session and saw a lot of drilling, a lot of coaching. The practice, which is the best term for it, began as Coach Danowski split the teams into those who had been with the U.S. national team before and those who had not. The majority of players who had not been with the U.S. team were current college players or recent college graduates, of whom there were about 18 or so late additions in early June. And, you know, by and large, it was very loose. That would be the way I would describe it, both in terms of mood, tone, as well as in terms of execution. Felt like we saw a lot of you know, defensive players and goalies taking shots. There was literally like a 20-minute session of defensemen and goalies feeding each other from below GLE for step-down shooting. It definitely seemed like the goal was to be loose, have fun, get to know each other, all that sort of good stuff. The session ended with a 15-minute round circle in which about a third of the players got up and introduced themselves to one another with their name, their hometown, where they played college lacrosse, and if so, where they currently play professional lacrosse, and then a fun fact about themselves. I was sitting in the crowd, so I wasn't able to hear every fun fact. The one I tweeted out was that Marcus Holman is going on a Euro trip with a number of his Utah coaching staff and other close friends. I found the entire thing to be a very clear reflection of John Danowski's style. But enough of my three-minute rant. I did that to set the tone because Kyle and Patrick are going to carry the rest of the conversation as they were in attendance Tuesday night for the most competitive session. Kyle, you were, in a word, giddy on Twitter last night as you watched what was, and always is, one of the most competitive settings for lacrosse. Describe what it was like to be there in person.
So it's strange because obviously I have a reputation for being, you know, grumpy and negative, and the glowing way in which I expressed my joy at watching what I see as the greatest practice I have ever seen. It's the highest level of competition I've ever seen in my life. I have to shout it out, like, every guy on the field sold out. It was unbelievable. Every player played to the best of their ability, to the highest of their capability, the entire time. And you don't see a lot of pro guys just in terms of games play that way in every game, because it's not feasible to play that way in every game. And I think guys were almost testing their limits to see how hard they could go. And that was the thing I found the most enjoyable, because nobody like had any wasted possessions. There was no waste. And that's not something that you see very often especially in a practice. Talking about practice. You know,
we are talking about practice.
Talking about practice, and it's the greatest. But the thing is, it's the greatest practice I've ever seen. Patrick, I think you feel the same way.
Yeah, I think to kind of underlie how good it was, it's not just like it is the greatest practice I've ever seen, but it's also, I think, a practice that was at a level that only could be surpassed in a similar environment, that you had not just great players going all out, but you also when you think about the coaching staff that was running it with John Donowski, Sean Nadelin, Joe Amplo, Charlie Toomey, that there was those are you know, when you have some of the best head coaches in lacrosse serving roles as you know, sounds like almost the role playing equivalent of for coaches of as assistant coaches coaching, you know, very specific things within the practice that Donowski was overseeing. It was just an incredibly high level practice that it could only be surpassed either at the subsequent sessions or 4 years from now.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that we kind of have to talk about too is like Terry saw a lot of, you know, drills when he went. We saw my favorite thing. We got there and they all took a lap, which is like, when did you ever see Paul Rabil take a lap? When was the last time he like took a lap with his team? Do you know what I mean? Like, that's kind of setting the tone for it's almost throwing it back for these guys. And you're talking about the coaching staff. You saw this coaching staff run these guys through half field sets, which thank God we're practicing half field sets if we're trying to beat Canada, guys. Like, thank you. Great job. Obviously something that needs to be improved upon if the US is gonna win gold.
Also, I just thought that's just an example of something that you see different, just given the number of players in their practice, that 75 guys is a lot of guys to get reps in practice. And so I think it makes sense that you're doing the type of high reps, moving guys in and out type of drills in a 6-on-6 setting just to be able to get enough guys through the drill.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that we're saying, they split the sets for 6-on-6. It was all one field at the U.S. Lacrosse Complex in Sparks, Maryland. And you saw, you know, guys get split up into offense and defense on both sides of the field. So one side of the field was guys attacking from X, doing big little picks, and then the other side in a 6-on-6 environment, and then the other side of the field was guys attacking from the top in a 6-on-6 environment, and both groups were switched, so we got to see everybody play in both. I watched primarily the dodging from X because that's the most interesting to me. That's where you saw guys back there that you wouldn't normally see back there, right?
Yeah, that's what I thought was perhaps the most interesting situation is they rotated. It was a drill practice environment, so you saw them just rotating everybody through regardless of where, you know, what kind of specialty you might have. So you saw, you know, Sergio Perkovic and Paul Rabil and Miles Jones, you know, setting picks behind the cage in a big little invert situation. You saw Matt Gibson running off of those picks on occasion, you know, normally an inside finisher type guy.
Yeah, my favorite pairing was Wolf and Pinnell, because it was almost like the defenders were like, what do we do?
These are the guys that we jump and flush the ball to the other guy, but then we flush it to a guy that we want to flush it from.
Yeah. 85% of our career. Yeah. No, yeah. That makes sense. So let's start there, because that obviously is one of the highlight positions. So, you know, that quarterback is going to be an interesting battle, but you mentioned in preparation for this podcast that you felt like there was a emerging number one unit, both at the midfield and at the attack, and that it grouped Jordan Wolf and Rob Pinnell together. So how did you see in a drill setting that manifest itself?
Well, it was interesting because we're just primarily talking about this drill. They ran this drill for a large percentage of the time they were there. And it was interesting to me because you would think that Rob Pinnell would be the guy at X and Wolf would kind of be running around. They actually flipped that, and Pinnell kind of turned into this like mellifluous finisher. It was unbelievable. At one point, I think I described this on Twitter. He caught a ball from Wolf, spun, dipped his stick down by his ankle, and flicked it in a full 360 motion.
It was backhand. It was essentially
a spinning backhander.
It was really similar to the hit Toga Nanakoke. Under Armour goal.
Yeah,
but if it were martial arts, it would have been a spinning back kick. That's the way I imagine
it. Exactly. It was a roundhouse.
Yes.
It was a roundhouse goal. And it was, you know, everyone, there wasn't that many people in attendance, but the people there were like, every single person was like, ooh. And like, coaches were like, ooh. You know, it's one of those things that you're not necessarily used to seeing on a daily basis, even though these guys are capable of doing that. I saw Wolf did a lot without the picks. And I thought he played very well. I thought Will Manny finished every shot I saw him take. And as a lefty being included into this group, That's huge, because I think that's something that you're looking for. You're looking for to split the field in half occasionally and attack certain matchups, especially in international play where you have more time to set things up in the 6-on-6. And I thought, you know, that group of Wolf, Pennell, and Manny doesn't like register as something you're like, that makes sense. But we watched it. Makes sense. It was like doing an equation in real time of these attackmen working together, changing their roles. And for me, that was the thing that was the most interesting, watching every unit, especially on offense, guys being told to go to spots that I know from watching them play pro for years, that's not a place where they are comfortable. But guys did, and you know, no one's questioning anything. It's Team USA tryouts, and they're just doing it. You know, you saw guys like, you know, again, something I tweeted about, Miles Jones ran 30 yards in a full sprint and beat two guys for a ground ball in the corner that was probably going out. He saves it, flicks it over, hits Jordan Wolf on the high point, pops it inside, and Pennell finishes. And it was easy. You know, it looked effortless. But you could see at the same time the effort was put into it to make it look
right. I think going back to kind of that group top six, the midfield, that was what I thought was also intriguing, was we got a lot of run of Rabel, Miles Jones, and Drew Schneider.
Yep.
And I thought it's something I think that you sort of knew was in their skill set, but you're not necessarily used to seeing them do, is Paul Rabel and Miles Jones are obviously, you know, two of the best dodging midfielders in the world. And you're used to seeing a lot of them, they're dodging to score or dodging to feed for an assist. But they were, I thought, much more willing to just give the ball up early and sort of just dodge a draw slide, then kick it to the next guy and kind of see what happens to spin it to open up something else where maybe 2-3 passes ahead.
Yeah, and also float to the opposite side of the ball to get that over-the-top pass, which we saw executed, you know, brilliantly. When you watch players of a highest level skill, they can actually do stuff that maybe coaches at a lower level tell you never to do, which is the low to the over-the-top high feed, which is a degree of difficulty that most players can't accomplish until, you know, a higher level of college or whatnot. And we saw that play happen time and again. Rabel hitting basically two-pointers. I mean, he hit two shots from 20 yards, and they were amazing. And you know, that kind of brings us to, you know, which kind of goalies stood out.
Well, hold on. Before we move on to that, there are a couple of attackmen that haven't come up yet that I want to address before we move on from that. So two guys that are returning U.S. team players that you haven't mentioned, Ned Crotty and Marcus Holman, and then another attackman who has not played for the U.S. team, but certainly whose inclusion in the squad there's been a lot of attention paid to in terms of the prospect, that being Matanowski. So Ned Crotty, Marcus Holman, Matanowski, what was the takeaway?
I didn't perceive them as getting a lot of touches. It's not as if they didn't play, but at one point, Terry, I was texting you, is Holman here? Is Danowski here? And that might have been a reflection of which side of the field I was watching more. But I, you know, some guys are easy to identify, some aren't. And, you know, we got a roster later on in the process while we were watching. But I think that just in my perception, those guys, and as well as, you know, Joe Walters, didn't get a ton of touches.
Patrick, what was your takeaway?
Yeah, I guess I just went through all the pictures that I took, and I don't think I have – I definitely do not have many pictures of those guys. That guys like Joey Sankey and Ryan Brown were getting a lot more run.
Ryan Brown was one that I wanted to talk about because in my estimation, when you look at that righty shooter, it is relatively an easy position to evaluate because the results are very objective. And to this point in MLL, given his MLL career and the way that he finished his college career, I would argue that he has as wide of a gap on the next player at that position as anyone in consideration. And I'm curious as to how he performed.
Well, I think though saying he's a righty shooter, he's a righty lefty shooter and inside finisher. That he's kind of a do it all off ball guy, which I think is one of the things that makes him really intriguing as a player on this team. Is that you can argue for putting him he might be one of the best lefty shooters that they have.
I just think he's the best shooter in lacrosse, I think for the majority of the time, you didn't see him float outside of 12 yards. He played inside a lot.
He also played behind. He carried the ball behind, and I thought very well. some of it was just forced by the drill that when you're the, you know, you're the next guy up in the drill and you're supposed to run a two-man game behind, you obviously need to carry the ball. But even in some of the scrimmage type situations, he was carrying ball the ball behind and dodging more than I'm used to seeing him, and I thought he did very well.
So it sounds like if we were going to put money on it right now and you were going to bet on the five attackmen that were going to get picked, it would be Pinnell, Wolf, Manny, Ryan Brown, and who would be the fifth?
I think it's Holman, just for versatility.
Yeah, I think Holman's probably a good pick. I think also could be Danowski. I thought Matt Gibson had some nice plays.
He actually played well, yes.
He got underneath against a couple defenders and had some, there weren't so much dives as crease jumps, that he scored on, which I think is something that that he can finish. He can catch and finish inside, as well as just about anybody. But I think looking for him to be able to do a little bit more than that, is and not be limited to just that role might be an important part of him making this team.
And before we move on, we'll come back to the midfielders because obviously there's some high profile conversations there, but Kyle, you started to talk about goalies. Let's not give short shrift to the polls, which we always do. One of the things that I noticed when I was analyzing the roster, sitting there watching practice develop, is that relative to the 2014 and 2010 team selections, in which I think we have reiterated and reinforced how important it is to prepare a team that is capable of beating Canada, there is a lack of guys with high-level NLL or Canadian box experience that can play at that end of the field. And I was struck and reminded by interacting on Twitter with Eric Martin. You can make an argument that in 2010, Eric Martin was maybe not the most important player on the team, but within the top three or four, and when you think back, unless you specifically think about his role, not many people probably have that reaction. But because of his physicality, because of his stature, because of his ability to body up with a lot of the big offensive players that Canada brought to the table, we're looking literally at John Grant Jr. at this moment. And because of his experience guarding those guys, he was an incredible asset. The type of thing that allowed Shaun Nadelin to play with a short stick and duplicate his skill set elsewhere on the field. And so as a result, you know, I thought that that's the type of guy that you'd want to see more from. When I look at this current 75-man list, you know, the guys with moderate to even marginally extensive indoor experience are Mitch Belisle, Joel White, Kyle Hartzell, and Mike Manley.
Yeah, but in terms of talking about a player like Martin, the most like Martin
is Tucker Durkin.
Yeah, that's he played well. I think that, you know, he's got a rep for throwing hard wood. And he did. And that's, you know, that's one of the things that was exciting to see too, is because you saw guys not hold back from their checks. Like, you're here to make this team, and it's a final game. And there was guys that threw a lot of hard checks. And the best thing about that, too, is that the reaction to those checks was not there.
What are you doing? What are you doing?
There's none of that. There was none of that. And I liked that a lot, obviously. But the thing is, you see guys like Joel White. You bring up Joel White. Joel White did Joel White things the entire time. Did he carry one-handed? Yes. You know, did he run in for a one-handed ground ball or a long pole? Yes. I mean, he had a lot of success. He ran a couple breaks. There was not a lot of transition play, obviously, done in this. That's a kind of
by design, hopefully,
and you know, either way, was effective to watch a lot of 6-on-6 play. There were a couple situations where they did random penalties. They're like, no mouth guard, you're out, and guys had to sprint out, and then it was a broken situation.
They're trying to practice. I think it seemed like the differences in the way, like the stoppages of play and sort of thing with the international rules.
Did you get a sense for the way in which the offense tried to, did they at any point try to manufacture traditional two-man game situations to see how defenders played those? Or was that something where we weren't able to evaluate defensive play because they were playing against Americans, not against Canadians?
I mean, they did that. That was kind of part of their behind the cage stuff. And in the 6-on-6 situations, it looked like they were always looking for the next pass, not necessarily just to beat one person or even the slide. I think a couple defensemen got a little bit, and I said this when I wrote my you know, recap of who I thought might make a team defensively. I think the deficiency in this group is that you don't have a ton of second guys, right? You have a lot of number one defensemen. So I was watching for that and watching to see who would stand out. I thought Jackson Place did really well, kind of hedging and helping. Friend of the podcast, Mike Evans, I thought did very well. And after being scratched for the All-Star game, but
what did you think of Joe Fletcher?
I didn't see a ton of Fletch.
I watched him. He played. He didn't necessarily stand out to me one way or the other as playing exceptionally well or not well.
Joe Fletcher, I believe
it was his birthday.
Yes.
Oh, that's good to know.
People, he got many happy birthday wishes.
He was, I believe, the last player cut from the 2014 roster, and was the, if memory serves, like, only college player to advance to that stage in the tryout process.
To the, like, final 25 or something. So, yeah.
Yeah, I thought, Fletcher is going to do what Fletcher does and has a very distinctive style of staying with his man and not letting anyone beat him. And by virtue of playing that style, you don't always stand out.
Right.
So maybe he kind of went under my radar there and I was looking for something else.
Well, part of the reason I asked about him then is because when you look at this list and you consider this the point that you're making about how much these guys are relied on to shut down one guy, I would say Joe, who does a really good job of utilizing his length to hedge effectively and cover a lot of space, is maybe not reputedly the best, but reputedly one of the second or third best guys on this list covering number twos and supporting.
I think that's fair. I think that's fair. But
point being that he probably should be included in a list of 6 to 7 polls, depending on how you shake down those, maybe as many as 8, also depending on whether or not they carry 2 faceoff specialists that are ultimately selected for the team. You know, that versatility is akin to what you talked about with respect to Marcus Holman. So, Kyle, I know you want to talk about him. Let's talk about the goalies.
Yeah, it was tough to pick out guys doing exceptionally well because, I mean, you're playing against the best offensive players in this scenario possible.
To refresh listeners, the goalies in consideration are Drew Adams, Tyler Fiorito, John Galloway, Adam Gittleman, Jack Kelly, and Brian Phipps.
Yeah, I thought everybody had a moment. That was my takeaway. Every one of those goalies had a moment during the day. I really thought that Galloway probably separated himself a little bit, but with his ability to clear and willingness to come out of the cage.
Yeah, and I thought I was going to say the same thing. That was my one that I think nobody played. There's no goals that I was like, wow, that was one he really needed to make. And there weren't necessarily a ton of there were a couple really nice saves. But I thought Galloway running the clear, especially the man down clear. Because they did when they did.
That's how you know it's high level lacrosse. If in your third practice you actually get to man down clears, which is something that, like, you know, a lot of high school teams don't get to until April.
But the reason they do it is because there's no clearing clock.
Right.
So you can run out the penalty. So it's an important international. Yeah. And I think that it's one thing you don't think about. Is that if your goalie makes a save when you're man down, that if you play well, that should end the penalty.
Right.
Because I think that's an advantage that Galloway has.
Yeah.
And I think also Adam Gittleman.
Yep.
I thought did well. And I think another guy who is maybe, you could arguably say he's the best goalie out of the cage or outside of the crease in the MLL.
I think if you're looking for, you know, which two goalies you want to take, do you want to pick guys with different styles or do you want to pick the best two? And how are you going to determine out of those best two who the best guy is? And for me, that's why I think that that's the way you go. I don't think that the style thing comes into it too much because I would say that Drew Adams and Galloway are similar, except for Galloway's a little more comfortable outside the cage.
Well,
but in their shot stopping ability, they're similar.
Are they the same hand?
I believe so.
That's a good question. No, Adams is lefty.
Yeah, that's what I thought. And Galloway's a righty. So those are, to me, the two most important distinctions from a goalie. The first is, you know, I thought that the U.S. team benefited in 2010 from knowing that Brian Daugherty was the starter and that Adam Fullerton was the backup. I think that you've seen, whether it's split halves or competition, that a willingness to have a quick hook, particularly in a tournament where you're probably only going to play 2, maybe 3, at most 4 highly competitive games if you're the U.S. national team, that quick hook and that temptation can be really negative, right? Yeah. Whereas if you know that you have one starter and you're going to ride him thick and thin, I think that's beneficial. I think the only way in which you would like to see something opposite is the two-handedness, the ability to both prepare and warm up through a two-handed approach, and then also know that your opponent has to prepare for two-handed, you know, for a goalie that's a righty or a goalie that's a lefty as well.
Or a goalie that can do both, like Gittleman.
That's true.
Switches stance. I think as far as that goes, that's definitely important. But the thing that's the most important for a goalie is stopping the shot. And that the thing is about all these goalies, you're talking about a guy that could be a second banana that doesn't threaten the first guy. I think all these guys are very similar level, high level goaltenders that just have very small holes or very small things that they're not great at doing that other goalies can do better.
I can say definitively that because he told me that Brian Phipps would willingly accept the role as a backup on this team.
Yeah, but Phipps...
Are there any guys who wouldn't? Came down to the choice of being the backup or not being on the team, are there any guys who would rather not be on the team?
I don't think that they...
Goalies would say that. I don't think. I think it means too much.
Yeah, that I can't imagine. I mean, I think you get into the question of maybe some of them would handle the role of the backup better, mm-hmm. but I don't think any of them...
Who hasn't been a backup on the list?
Have a first or last kind of mentality.
I think Drew Adams and Galloway... Drew Adams was a backup to Doc. Galloway was... I think Galloway is the only one on the list that was never really a backup. Right?
Yeah.
Everybody else has been a backup.
And I would say Galloway is probably, in my estimation, the leader in the clubhouse in terms of the likelihood of making the team and starting.
I agree. I definitely agree. I think he's just at that level, and he has that respect.
He's in his prime, too.
Yes.
And he has he was a volunteer assistant on John Donowski's staff, so that's probably the height of familiarity between those two groups, you know, coaching staff and goalie, among the considerations. So, all right, let's move on to the other specialists, even though some of them hate that term. At the Faceoff X, what did the Faceoff guys do Tuesday night?
You're the Faceoff guy.
Well, they, during the first drill, when they went to some 6-on-6 sets, the Faceoff guys went off by themselves. They did some individual work. I thought one of the drills I thought was really interesting is they did a ground ball drill, but they went back to back, like sitting down with the ball directly underneath them.
So like duck, duck, goose, back to back,
trying to box their guy out to pick up the ground ball.
Interesting.
Because the ground ball is basically slightly behind both of you.
Yeah.
So you can't just reach. If you reach and grab it, the other guy will push you off and he'll get it. So you have to box the other guy out and then find a way to kick the ball out or pull it out in front of you to pick up the ground ball.
And if the guy pushes too hard, you can just pull the chair.
Right. That's the other. That's the other. Yeah.
Which coach was running this or paying the most attention to it?
It wasn't somebody that I recognized.
Oh, interesting. Oh,
okay.
I didn't go over closely to see them. I didn't get close enough to pick them out of the lineup, but I'm familiar with Amplo, Natalin, the college head coaches.
And it was not one of them.
It wasn't the college head coach that I recognized.
Got it.
Yeah. I don't want to say that it wasn't.
I wonder if it was Sean Smith, a former Hofstra assistant, and I believe now had spent time with the New York Lizards as well and familiar with John Donowski. But in any case, moving on, I mentioned that
They also made them play some defense. Yes. in one of the subsequent sets, which is one of the reasons we didn't get to see them face off a ton. They also did a drill. It was I always call it almost like a face-off transition drill, but they had them get down, and then a coach, instead of placing the ball in front of them, would just toss it out, yep. To a wing or to them to pick it up, so they were participating, but not actually facing off against each other, which I wasn't quite sure what the purpose of that was, rather than letting them just...
Well, it's like a, you're seeing which guy can get to the ball faster.
Fair enough, but I mean, and the other thing to keep in mind is that international face-off rules are basically old school. And so in kind of chatting with a couple of them beforehand, the kind of reaction is it's weird. After all of them have been coaching with college rules for a couple years now, and now the MLL has basically gone to the college procedure. It's sort of I got to remember how to cheat, basically. roll into it on the whistle, jump it early, because there's no more... there's not three violations doesn't cause a penalty.
You can carry the ball in back of your stick.
Right, you can carry the ball in your back of your stick.
We saw that happen.
Gerenlian carried down the back of his stick and just launched it nowhere close. But I think that's what it's if it has a chance to get stuck in the back of your stick, you don't want to risk popping it out and not having it come. So just launch it, and then you'll know it's going to come out, even if it's stuck.
Right.
And just have a guy back it up. It's a possession shot.
Yeah, I think the one of the other important distinctions that you know we talked about on Twitter a little bit was Fowler, you know, suited up, but didn't fully participate. And I mean, you talked to him afterwards. Right?
Yeah, he it's an issue with it with his foot. And he's not that he has a he's a bone spur that he's been playing through.
Yep.
And so it's his kind of medical future. It's undetermined. He's going to go try to get some more information about it to see what the best option is.
And then Thomas Kelly, you know, injured in the All-Star game, was there in attendance but did not participate. He does expect to be back in a couple weeks, ready to go. He's going to be sore for a while, but you know he thinks that he's going to be able to participate probably in the next round if he makes it through.
Right. I would say when they did face off, though, Baptiste, Grenlian, and Nardella all won face-offs against each other.
Yeah.
I don't think there was any clear separation.
I thought out of those guys, Baptiste did the best job in terms of getting the ball out.
He lost two clamps to Grenlian.
Right, but he won one back, and Grenlian violated one.
Right.
I thought that he – I'm not going to say that – it's almost similar to the goalie situation where it's like – the separation is so minor that it's hard to say, like, who did best.
Yeah, well,
I would say Baptiste did the best out of this group. From what I saw.
Potentially. The other thing is you have to remember they're all still getting used to the international rules again.
Right.
That I don't know – I'm not sure how much time they may have spent and had the opportunity to face off against somebody
under
international rules, like with a – fine, because, I mean, to get used to that, so –
on a 23-man international roster, obviously in 2006 when the U.S. lost to Canada and didn't have a pure face-off specialist, the cognitive choice was made that that's not going to happen again. But there is some disagreement over whether or not a better approach is carrying one pure face-off specialist who's going to take as many draws as possible and supplement him with other midfielders or long sticks who have experience taking draws and can be effective, or having two draw specialists, face-off specialists. Do you guys have a preferred philosophy for this U.S. national team?
I like two, but with a caveat that if you take one, then you're really confident in one, then you have to take a guy like CJ Costabile that can also take face-offs.
I agree. I think it depends who the guy is.
That's one point that I was going to make. I think that Trevor Baptiste is the only player where you can carry one face-off guy because he's the only one right now with the track record of health that suggests that he'd be able to play 9 games in 12 days or whatever the demand is and not see significant decline in his performance or increase in his injury risk.
Yep, and also you have to look at it. I guess they're all going to get it through the MLL now, but presumably I think the odds are fairly significant that we know the important battle is against Jake Withers.
Yeah.
And
definitely something to watch.
And Baptiste is a guy who's faced off. He's faced off in college, but that's under college rules, though. Which I guess it's one of those tricky things that who knows what
who has the advantage under international.
Well, but
rules.
How is Jake Withers going to adapt? Because I think it looks to me like all of their stances are slightly tweaked for international rules. I don't think they're facing off the same. It's not significant. Like Grenlian's been facing off standing up the MLL. I think in part. Because I saw him stand. He stood up on every faceoff that he took, and potentially that's why he's been doing it in the MLL. He's been in the past more of a knee down guy,
right.
But this season it's been mostly stand up. And I would venture to guess that he's been thinking about this week of practice, with that decision to practice more of a stand up stance.
Yeah. All right, so let's shift back to the midfielders, the glory position. You talked about Rabel, Miles Jones, and Drew Snyder appearing to emerge as a number one. You mention or you exclude the reigning MLL MVP, who has probably the most familiarity of playing offense against who will likely be the defensive players for the Canadian national team. That being Tom Schreiber. What did you see out of his performance?
I mean, when they went to a scrimmage and the scrimmage got artificially pushed into overtime, no complaints there for me because it was awesome. But Schreiber is the guy that got the ball and eventually ended up dishing the game-winning assist to Ryan Brown after not getting a ton of touches. And I would actually argue that in terms of experience and guys playing against Canadians, Joe Walters would have that.
True, true. I was the victim of recency bias as it relates to this most recent NLL season. You're right. So what did you think of Walters?
I thought Walters did not get enough touches. I wanted to see more. I wanted more JW1 in my life, and I didn't get it. But I think that that's almost by design, because some of the older guys, they're very familiar with. This staff is very familiar with, and they know what they can do. Maybe it's a case of that. Maybe it's a case of we're going to give him more touches in the next round, or unlikely, maybe we're not going to bring him on.
Right.
You know, but I think in terms of guys that stood out that I did not expect to stand out, the number one candidate there is Sergio Salcido, who is undersized in this group, but was so quick and so great at dodging. I don't think he even got checked. I mean, he looked phenomenal. And I was shocked.
I agree with your observation, but I wouldn't necessarily characterize myself as shocked, because I think he's a guy. He was the number one player on one of the best offenses in college lacrosse this year.
Yep.
Where he was kind of when games were on the line late in the game, it was okay, Sergio, pull.
I'm not shocked from that though. I'm shocked from you're thrust into this experience as someone that has very little experience against this level of player. And this,
but what they were at, but essentially, what we kind of talked about with Rabel and Miles Jones, where you're more asking just guys, all we need you to do is draw a slide and kick it. We don't need you to be the hero. And I think that he's so quick that he can draw slides so easily, and he's a feed first guy, that when you put him in the role of okay, you have a short stick, all we need, just draw a slide and kick it to the next guy and get things moving. Like he is tailor-made for that role. And so I think that helps with the moment not be too big for him, in that you're asking him to do something that his core fundamental skill set.
Let's stay on this topic, but open up the conversation a little bit. I have always, and dating back to the 2010 tryouts in 2009, been an advocate for carrying a college player with an eye toward two things. The first is youthful energy, and the second is versatility, particularly offensively. So in 2010, I thought the two most important offensive players were Mike Lavelle and Ned Crotty, because of their ability to run out of the box and invert and keep the Canadian team on their heels. I thought Marcus Ullman was tailor-made to represent that same role and reprise that same role in 2014. That's the perspective with which I look at the college player's contribution. That said, there's probably about 10 guys who I want to ask about, and not a reaction to every 10 guy, just did anyone really impress, aside from Salcido, and we've already talked about Baptiste, and did anyone else notably look like they didn't belong? So the college players who were invited and in attendance: Connor Canizzaro, Matt Rambo, Dylan Malloy, Ben Reeves, Jake Ficarro, Connor Kelly, Sergio Perkovic, and then a pair of pulls in Larkin Kemp and Tim Muller.
For me, it seemed as if they had a lot of confidence in giving Kelly the ball, and he got a lot of runs. It just in my perspective, I think the same thing for Ficarro
and Canizzaro.
And it's worth noting that Kelly is the only one in that group who has another year in college, which says something about everything with respect to what type of attention we should pay to Connor Kelly next year.
And I think that Connor Kelly took a little bit to get used to it. I think that he had to ease in, and the coaches were patient with him. The players were patient with him. He did much better at the end of practice than he did at the beginning. In terms of other guys, I don't think Dylan Malloy was there. And if he was, I didn't see him do anything.
He's so big, I can't imagine.
Yeah, I saw him on Monday night.
I can't imagine that, like, especially down when you're in line with like Will Manny, Jordan Wolf, Connor Canizzaro, and you're 6'3", 220. There's no way that we would. I can't imagine that we missed him. Yeah, I don't think he was out.
Ben Reeves got very little burn, but did play, and I didn't see him really do anything.
He didn't do anything bad, but he just wasn't very aggressive. It was a lot of just move the ball the next guy around the perimeter.
Yeah.
He didn't really do much.
In terms of college, if we're talking about college players, we're mostly talking about Baptiste, and this next group you're asking us about, I thought Kelly and Vaccaro did the best, as along with Salcido. Those would be my three, my four college guys to watch going forward.
I thought Vaccaro had a nice play where he cut in the middle, caught a pass, ran out of an angle, turned and fed it to the next, like, turned, spun, and fed it to the next guy cutting in behind him for a goal.
That was Manny.
Couple other stars that I want to hit on before we move on from the U.S. national team conversation that haven't come up yet. Matt Abbott.
Abbott, you know, he's one of those chameleons. Like, I do remember seeing him play. He did get a couple shifts at midfield, especially in the drill where they were running from the top down. And I thought he did well. And it's funny because, like, you know, you mentioned him. He's actually done really well offensively in the MLL this year. He's really stepping it up on that end of his game and being one of the glue guys for the Bayhawks. I thought he played well. I don't recall him playing a ton of defense.
I think they ran him as an offensive midfielder.
They ran him mostly as an offensive midfielder.
Certainly in the drills.
Yes.
And, I mean, I guess in the scrimmage, you know, guys were – there was a decent amount of playing two ways.
Yeah.
But, I would say for the most part he did Matt Abbott things and didn't – it wasn't – he didn't stand out to me playing exceptionally well or poorly.
Guy with a similar type of ilk, John Hawes, who's been incredibly high scoring midfielder in MLL so far this year, but you know has a reputation as a two-way guy dating back to his days at Maryland.
Yeah, I think Hawes, Chanchuk, and other Hawes, blended together for me.
Okay,
and I actually had to wait to get the roster to see who was who because they were all playing kind of that ball carrying but not working for your own shot role in most of the drills. Will Hawes did play a lot more defense. I was like, oh, that has to be Will Hawes also because he's taller. So
yeah, I thought of them, I would say Will Hawes defensively stood out to me the most. I thought he played well.
Yep.
Jeremy Sieverts.
Sieverts carried a lot. Sieverts is not, I'm not saying he's a feast or famine guy, but he's a guy where he's either making spectacular plays or he's making the right play. And I thought he made more right plays than any spectacular plays. But he carried well. He didn't, you know, there wasn't a lot of stripping going on. You know, in this whole scenario, there weren't a lot of, like, takeaway checks thrown. I thought he did pretty well. I think the only time, you know, defense got to shine was, like, anytime they fed the ball inside, someone got killed, which I enjoy.
Yeah.
Another guy that I think we haven't talked about
yet. Yeah, I would say just to agree, it was Jeremy Sieverts. Like, that's Jeremy Sieverts doing Jeremy Sieverts things.
Yes.
There was nothing that wowed me, but nothing. He definitely did not play poorly.
Yeah, I still noticed him. A guy I want to touch on, Connor Busick, I thought played like an animal all night. He delivered a hit on Jake Bernhardt coming across the crease that, like, crack, 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 echoed throughout the back of the building and back onto the field. And people were like, oh. And then, you know, Bernhardt got up and they both ran off. But it was a tone setter because it happened in the early part of the man up drills, and he just like flew across. He also shot the ball like he was trying to shoot it through a wall, like the entire time. And you know, I mean, I called it out on Twitter. I thought, you know, he just stood out to me, and he didn't score a ton of goals. He didn't make a ton of plays, but every time I saw him, he was full motor.
I would say that is, you know how you do that thing where you say, tell people reach as high as you can and then reach a little bit higher?
Yeah.
That this in terms of hustle, this is playing faster, more hustle than it, just everything was as much as Connor Busick could bring. And I thought he was part of what brought the intensity and brought everybody else up. I also thought Jake Bernhardt played well. Defensively, yes. It was another defensive midfielder.
I want to mention something about Connor Busick because this is not the first time he's done that, and it wouldn't be the first time that he's made a U.S. national team because he was a surprise selection on the U19 U.S. team in, I believe, 2010 or 11, and maybe it was 2009. Patrick, you might be able to verify this. I believe he was the first selection for a U.S. U19 lacrosse team out of Ohio.
I couldn't verify that he's the first, but I mean, he certainly is from Ohio. I can verify that.
There we go. All right, one more guy I want to touch on before we two. Kyle, you mentioned in conversation about the defense and the lack of number ones. I'm sorry, the lack of non-number ones. That this tryout almost needed a little bit more of Notre Dame defensemen. Mm-hmm. Matt Landis is the only Notre Dame defenseman.
Garrett Eppel.
You're right. I'm sorry. Okay. Well, then, how about both of them?
I thought they were put in positions where they were help guys. And I didn't see them. So no one attacked them. Do you know what I mean? Like, they did well on the inside, kind of shading to the spot they needed to be at in case something happened. But I don't think that they had many plays on the ball to make. So I think that's a situational thing. I think they did as well as they could with what they were given, but they weren't given a lot of stuff to work with. You know, they're like actors brought in to do like deliver a couple lines, and they did that. But I don't think they were counted on to do anything.
But I think that potentially hints at, especially for Matt Landis, who you think of as a number one cover guy. But I think in part potentially because, he wasn't always the number one at Notre Dame,
right?
And I think he is somebody who was like you talked about with Fletcher, who could be asked to be an off ball cover help slide type guy.
Yeah.
And you almost saw some of that out of him in college because there were teams that knew that they didn't want any part of dodging against him, and so would just take him to the crease.
Yeah.
When he was a senior, and so I think that is a role. He's
more familiar with it than you might expect based on his profile as a college defender.
Yes, as a top cover guy.
Last one for me, Kieran McArdle.
This.
All right, I think that's all we need to hear.
I don't know if I didn't see a lot of him or he didn't carry the ball a lot, but I don't have anything nothing he did stood out to me.
Yeah, I would say the same. And maybe it was just I was watching the other end. He might have ended up more on the other end of the field from what I was watching. But I similarly would agree that I didn't see, just don't remember seeing much of him.
All right, well, that'll do it for the U.S. National Team tryouts portion of this podcast. Check InsideLacrosse.com later in the week for whatever news is coming out of the player selection, and we will come back to you with some analysis of those selections. In the meantime, Patrick, you are putting together a photo gallery to go up live on Wednesday on InsideLacrosse.com. But Kyle, we can't get out of the MLL podcast without talking about the MLL. Like I said at the top of the show, the All-Star Game was in Sacramento. There were almost 8,000 fans in attendance, which was a major success relative to the narrative leading up to that.
And over last year, it was a big improvement.
Yes,
over last year.
And I believe the number pretty much.
What was your overall takeaway?
I thought presentation wise, it was what it was going to be. It was never going to be like this huge spectacle with like fireworks and bombs going off in the background and you know all of that stuff. But I think the players put on a show, and I thought the show was spectacular. You had to wait for it a little bit. I don't know about this $10,000 reward thing that they put in for
MVP. Did anybody know that was coming as of, like, Wednesday?
No. That was a spur-of-the-moment thing that happened before the game, just like, you know, many of these players were left, and no one said anything. And our podcast was rendered completely worthless as a result of our fantasy draft. But, you know, in terms of all of this, you know, strife and speculation, and guess what? I'm the band leader. I get it. It's almost like the MLO is like my little brother, where, like, you can pick on him and pick on him and stuff, but there's a line. And I think people on Twitter crossed the line a little bit, and now I have to throw bows back.
People or players?
Both.
Okay.
I would say both. And I think that it was not, you know, dealt with very well by the league. And you know, again, I'm very critical of the league office. I totally admit that. If you're listening to this podcast, you already know that. I have no problem pointing out the warts on the witch's face, okay? But the other thing is, the players are never at fault. It's not the players' fault that they got selected to the All-Star game and left to go try out for Team USA. There's an importance there. The thing that becomes their fault is when the league and them, by the way, and them, did not say they were doing that. And I don't know if the league told them not to. I don't know if they chose not to. You know, but either way, it was misleading. And that, I don't agree with that. I don't like that. None of you listen to this podcast like that either. No one wants to be lied to by a professional league or players. But if I'm going to pick anything out, the players are wrong. That's the only thing they did wrong. Because everybody that showed up sold out. And it wasn't for $10,000. It was for the fans.
By the way, about the $10,000, I mean, if you're Marcus Holman and you had 5 goals at halftime and no one had more than one and you didn't win.
Yeah. I thought I was going to get in trouble for the tweet I sent out, but I didn't yet. Maybe you didn't see it. But I think that scoring the OT winner is the rationale there.
Yeah, of course it is.
But yeah, I would be disappointed. And people going to Hawaii with Marcus Holman for the tournament are upset he's not paying for their mai tais.
Yes, yes. Any moments? What will be the most memorable moment of the 2017 All Star Game? The skills competition in a public park.
Oh man, I didn't even know we were going to talk about that. I was going to put that off the table. I could make a joke out of this and be like, I don't know, Tommy Kelly selling out and injuring his shoulder and missing Team USA tryouts as a result, and proving the point for all the people that left. That's tough. That's a tough breakaway from that. That's tough to take away. But I think that the thing to take away, I don't know if there's a moment so much as it's actually, for me, the moment was Ratliff leading two breaks that resulted in two spectacular goals. If I can't pick one play, just phenomenal. He's such a great player. We didn't really talk about him in the Team USA conversation. I don't think he stood out a lot in that group, just in terms of what was going on with the drill. He's very much an open field player. I think he's still a great defender and a great ball handler, but you know, in international rules, some guys, their strengths are no longer their strengths. They have to find new ones.
One thing I do want to say about that, though, is that while Scott is very strong and one of the most invested physical players, because he's not heavy, in U.S. national team's past, he might have gotten viewed, that might have been viewed as a considerable detriment to his claim. It's no longer true, nor should it be reacted to, that this Canadian offense has a ton of beef on it that needs to be counteracted with 225-pound defensemen and long poles. So he does fit on this U.S. team, whether it's guarding Jeremy Noble or somebody to that effect, in a way that he didn't previously, and I think that's important to keep in mind.
Also, I mean, he is. I would just say he's average-sized. He's not small.
No, but I do think that in many people's minds, he's certainly willing.
He's certainly, I think, willing to step up and be physical. That's not. I don't think that's
compared
an issue.
To guys like on this list, CJ Cosville, Michael Earhart.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Small. Yeah. Yes. Okay.
He's slight.
He is not as big. He's not as big as those guys. Right. But I wouldn't necessarily say he is. He is still much bigger than Jeremy Noble.
100%. I think, you know, closing thoughts on the All-Star game for me, I'm really happy that the players showed out. The players that showed up and put on a show. I think maybe if we're talking about iconic moments, Miles Jones taking off his helmet on air and saying, "My hair looks great on the Jumbotron," is going to live on in
meme form. In meme form.
I hope so.
We'll have to make that. We'll have to make that into a gift.
We'll have to do that. We'll definitely do that.
All right, guys, this is it for the Inside Lacrosse podcast. The MLL podcast that was devoted this week to the U.S. national team. I want to thank Patrick McEwen and Kyle Devitt for sweating through this in a very, very warm Jeep Liberty 2008 vintage. It was the first year of the redesign, as I'll have you know, as we overlook Field 12 of the Inside Lacrosse Recruiting Invitational July session at Cedar Lane Park in beautiful Bel Air, Maryland. Thanks to U.S. Lacrosse for allowing us to come and watch tryouts at U.S. Lacrosse headquarters in Sparks, Maryland. Thanks to the 75-some players who showed up and put on a special performance. And thanks to all you listeners once again for checking us out. We'll be back on Friday with a full recap of the recruiting scene and landscape. Obviously, a lot of attention paid to what has gone on here in Bel Air the last 3 days. And then we'll be back next week with the traditional standards latest podcast. So thanks as always. Give us a rating and a review on iTunes, because that really helps us out. And we will catch you guys next week.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.